Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Gary Simpson, and he will be speaking on Promising God. So let's listen in on Gary Simpson.
What I intend to do is look at some passages with you together of the Large Catechism. I find the Large Catechism some of the some fun things to do with Luther, primarily because he's, in some ways, he's not writing, at least the polemics isn't right on the page. There are a few every once in a while. But it's a way to read Luther on the commandments. The other way to read him on the commandments is to read some of his sermons. And in some ways, in the Large Catechism, he's being about as sermonic as anything. So there's two sides. And I propose today to take a look at the first commandment. I may, as the week goes on, do more and more with the Bible and the commandments, because one of the things that you'll find out is the commandments aren't very often, the Ten Commandments are quoted twice in the Old Testament, and once in Exodus 20, which is what we're mostly familiar with, and also in Deuteronomy 5. And it seems like all the rest of the laws of the commandments in the scriptures are kind of take off from the basics of the Ten Commandments. One of the things, as I was thinking about weaving a world tapestry, which is the theme for this summer, is one of the questions that's going on, I think, in the issues of multicultural and cross-culturalism is, are there any things that actually cross over from one culture to another? Or are cultures just purely different, and therefore you can't... They're in what some people call incommensurable. It basically, when it comes to moral life, each culture has its own moral particularity, and you can live within it, but there are very few, or if any, things that cross moral, that cross cultural boundaries, or that cross over from one culture to another. And as I was thinking of, I don't know anything about weaving, hardly at all. Who's a weaver? Any weavers? Oh, that's too bad. I was hoping to go on the expertise of some weavers. But there are, when you weave something, you have to start off with, I think, what they call the warp. The first thing you put is the warp. I think the warps are the ones that go this way. No, that's not. And then the woof is the ones that go this way. Oh, no. That's, isn't this the woof, what goes back and forth? And the warp are what goes up and down. That's what I was told. So I titled this Warp 10. And if you listen to Star Wars, it sounds like the speed of
pretty fast,
as fast as Starship Enterprise could go. But it might be a suggestion that in order to weave a tapestry, there are some, while there are lots of fragments that you can put into the woof, there are some strands that you have to have that kind of hold the whole thing together, despite all the different kinds of fragments and differences that you might use for the woof. And I think one of the things I'm going to suggest, maybe, or at least we could explore this question, is whether the Ten Commandments might be something like this, the warp, that which holds all the many kinds of cultures and peoples and identities together into a world. Talking about the world tapestry. Well, anyway, that's one of the things we can explore during the week. I think I put in the title something like Culture Wars, and we may get into those a little bit as we move into some of them, particularly the second table, number 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, we may get them early on, too. What I thought we'd do is just do some reading and stop and go along the way. And so I don't really intend to do a lot of lecturing, although it's a real big temptation, so I may end up doing that anyway. Let's start off. I thought I'd start off with reading where the Ten Commandments appear in Exodus, the 20th chapter. If you read in the 19th chapter, you've got the people of Israel at Mount Sinai. And Moses is basically having these on and off visits with God, where he's going up and down the mountain. I don't know how many times he goes up and down, probably 5, 6, or 7 times. He's like he's scaling the mountains up and down Mount Sinai. And God is having conversations with him, and Moses is told by God to put a boundary around the mountain so that the people can only come up to the boundary because God is going to speak to them kind of directly. And this seems to be now when God begins to speak directly to the people. And so in chapter 20, it goes like this. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And then it starts, you shall have no other gods before me. So in the beginning, there's this identification of who God is, the one who brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a graven image, for any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes God's name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work. You or your son or your daughter, your manservant or your maidservant, or your cattle, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in the 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. So what's interesting is that's the one of the significant differences between Exodus recording and the recording in Deuteronomy. Why the Sabbath? And here we've got because creation is 6 days and God rests. And remember why the Sabbath is in Deuteronomy. Maybe you can go back and think about that. There it was because people were slaves. I assume that they had to work every day of the week, all the time. And so God has freed them from slavery, and therefore the rest is kind of the remembrance of their freedom and the exercise of their freedom. Maybe. Well, keep going on. 12. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his manservant, or his maidservant, or his ox, or his ass, or anything that is your neighbor's. The end of the 10 words, and then it continues on. Let's take a look at Luther. One of the things we might ask in this first, as we begin now, is that as Luther thinks about the Ten Commandments, and as Luther thinks about the First Commandment, think about how he's thinking about who God is, what kind of God there is, also what's going on about who we are, who are human beings, and what are human beings up to in the world. Somebody want to start reading? Maybe read the first, you notice the paragraphs are numbered on the right side. Maybe somebody read 1, 2, and 3.
You shall have no other gods. That is, you shall regard me alone as your God. What does this mean, and how is it to be understood? What is it to have a God? What is God? Answer. A God is that to which we look for all good and in which we find refuge in time of need, every time of need. To have a God is nothing else than to trust and believe Him with our whole heart. As I have often said, the trust and faith of the heart alone make both God and an idol. If your faith and trust are right, then your God is the true God. On the other hand, if your trust is false and wrong, then you have not the true God. For these two belong together, faith and God. That to which your heart clings and entrusts itself is, I say, really your God.
Well, what kinds of things you find out about God here, according to Luther, from Luther's perspective? This is one of the more famous passages, probably the most famous passage, out of the Large Catechism. This section on this paragraph.
The concept of trust is mentioned over and over again.
Trust. Say anything about God, or say anything about us, or what does that? Why do you think that that's so, or what for Luther might be so significant about that?
That's one of all goodness found in his only kindness.
Now that says something particularly about God, huh? The source of all good in our life, the author of good, the one from whom God good comes. Now Luther, probably he was wrong, but at least he thought in German, the word for good and the word for God were related. Now, most linguists think that that's not the case, but at least Luther in his day thought that gut and got, God and good, even in English we have sound alike, look alike, were related to each other. What else? Anything else about God?
Well, there's a radical statement here that trust and faith make God.
Ah.
Redefine.
Make both a God
and
an idol. Why is that so radical, Fred?
Well, if there was no faith and trust, would there be no God?
Ah. Well, what else? What else? Well, what's assumed by the... the commandments all have some assumptions behind them, don't they? You think about it. If you just think about the commandment, thou shalt have no other God before me. What are some of the assumptions behind that statement?
That there are other gods.
That there are other gods, or also at least possible other gods, huh? What else?
You can make something a god.
You can make something into a god. Well, what's a god?
Does that mean you can have gods after me?
You can have gods after me. Like,
well, I'm saying,
like second gods.
Yeah, demigods.
Demigods. Wow, that's possible. That might assume that. In fact, in Israel, can you think of any times in Israel when the Israelites themselves were asking that kind of a question? There's some stories that kind of come to my mind from Bible class when I was a kid, Sunday school.
Golden calf.
Well, right after here, you've got the golden calf, right? The story of the golden calf. Now, there's a lot of interesting kind of things. If we read that story about the golden calf in, which is what? It's one of the first stories that comes up now.
Right after.
What else?
I said it's in 32.
It's in 32, yeah. So just a few
also
chapters.
Also, when they want to go back.
They want to go back to Egypt. What does that have to... What was going on in their wanting to go
faith
back?
Faith and trust was gone.
Trust was gone. Or challenged, at least, huh? What other kinds of stories of trying to maybe have demigods? Maybe not saying, well, God, we want to get rid of you, or we don't believe you anymore, or we don't trust you anymore. But how about you and?
Secondary backup.
Yeah, how about backup? A few backups.
Baal.
Ah, I can think of, I remember the Elijah story. And the prophets of Baal. You remember, as a kid, that's always a dramatic thing. It's kind of dramatic. You build this altar here, and you build this altar here, and you pour water out. It's kind of like, in case of high fire hazard, you pour water on it, and put moats around it.
Even collecting extra manna.
Oh, collecting extra manna. Let's say some more about that.
That the trust was gone because it might not be there the next day.
Oh, so true. And what's the manna like? What's the
life,
manna? What's
life
the
support?
Life, right? Subsistence. Life, not subsistence. What's the lesson even St. Paul draws in, I think it's 2 Corinthians 8, isn't it? Where he draws on the manna existence when he's talking to the Corinthians and trying to get them to be good stewards for the poor congregation in Jerusalem. And there's kind of a maxim that comes out of manna existence. It's where everybody gets enough and nobody gets too much. It's interesting because it says that, you know, everybody gets enough, nobody gets too much. So you can't hoard and you can't be underfed. Well, that might come into the seventh commandment a little later on. Actually, Luther's going to have some things to say very similar to the story about manna later when we get to the seventh commandment on Thursday or so. Yeah, Thursday.
I've always thought of a sort of self-sufficiency. They really took it upon themselves to be their own gods for a while. That they would harvest a little extra manna.
Oh yeah, they tried to get a little extra.
Yeah.
And what would happen when they did that?
Well, their faith was not on a God who supplies everything.
Actually, I think the manna didn't just dissipate. It spoiled.
2 cups of manna in the hand
is worth
more than manna in the bush.
More than a manna in the bush. I think this is the quail. What else? Anything else? Faith. Now, Fred raises this. He called it a radical statement. Why is that radical? Actually, in the history of modern theology, Fred knows that that's kind of a radical statement. But what does that say about us? Why does Luther make such a big deal out of it?
Well, we're by nature God writes or something.
God?
God writes, like playwrights and millwrights.
I see.
We're God makers.
God makers. Instead of God being human makers, we're God makers. That sounds like kind of one of the paradoxes, what I would call the ironies or the paradoxes that you were pulling out of the Mark 9 text this morning. And I think there's also some things, it's hard to think about, you know, what was going on in Luther's time. But at least probably the main Christian tradition about who human beings were, what a human being is, up until the time of Luther, was to think of human beings intrapsychically. Christians usually describe a human being by certain, almost in a certain sense, mechanistically, by certain, well, they call them virtues and powers that were internal to individuals. What's kind of interesting is Luther doesn't go into any of those kinds of speculations when he talks about what is a human being. For him, I think, in fact, what he's saying here is what a human being is. A human being is somebody who, what? Is what? Maybe incurably theistic, or God-oriented, or God-connected, or God-dependent, if you use Schleiermacher. Or has to trust, as Luther will call a human being, we are trusters. Now I think he uses this notion of trust or faith quite specifically. And that's quite new. Trust is something, trust is always a relational word. So Luther is really moving into, I think, away from an idea of human beings as some kind of a stuff that has certain characteristics, into talking about human beings as a creature that is always, well, related to something outside of the human being. That we always trust upon or in. Luther said that human beings lived always outside of ourselves. In Latin, that with extra nos, outside of oneself, outside of yourself. I was at breakfast this morning, and a man gave a testimony. I think it was breakfast this morning. He gave a testimony of a vision that he had. And I happened to walk into the later one. I ate breakfast in the earlier one, and he came through with a cup of coffee in the later one. And he was using the exact same word, kind of interesting word that he used, that most Lutherans don't like to use very often. Remember what word he used? He talked about it being an ecstatic experience. He said it was the most ecstatic thing that's ever happened to him. Now, Fred was pushing us to this kind of irony of that human beings are God makers, whereas the first commandment was talking about God being human makers. At least the first article of the Creed later on, Luther kind of, I often wonder whether Luther's kind of paralleling the first commandment with the first article. The second commandment having to do with name. God is the one who is, has crucified, has crossed at God's heart with the second. And Luther on the word, maybe we'll think about that. Luther, remember the Sabbath day, he interprets that and talk about being where the word of God is, the living word of God. Being closer to what's going on in the Holy Spirit. Actually, he's talking about humans. Humans are that creature that somehow have to live outside of themselves. So you notice what the commandment doesn't say. It doesn't say, thou shalt have a God. It doesn't command us to have a God. Humans are the kind of creature that God does not have to command to have a God. I think Luther thinks that it's impossible for the human creature, as one of God's creatures, not to have a God. And so Luther uses these relational words like trust. Small catechism, remember the small, what does this mean? We should fear, love, trust in God above all things. So he uses this, and then the first two, fear and love, they appear in all the rest. Remember, we should fear and love God that we may not love about. We may not fear and love all the rest of our fear and love. There's kind of a paradox in that, maybe. Since why it's interesting that Luther would talk about fear and love, always putting the little and together in there. But in the first one, then, he has trust. All of those are rather relational. As I have often said, the trust and faith of the heart alone, for Luther, I think the heart is at the center of our existence, the wholeness of our existence, make both God and Israel. If your faith and trust are right, then your God is the true God. Of course, now that if, that the conditional right there was, Luther didn't forget to put that in, whereas a few people after him forgot that he had put that in. Because later on he will talk about who this God is, the maker of heaven. On the other hand, if your trust is false and wrong, then you have not the true God. For these two belong together, faith and God. That to which your heart clings and entrusts itself is, I say, really your God. Well, I think that's an interesting question whoever raised it. Can we have other kinds of... We go to 4:30, huh? No, 4:45. We have other gods, second gods. We might want to think about that. Whether any of us do. Probably not in this room.
I sure cling to and trust my wife an awful lot.
Trust your wife an awful lot.
And cling to.
And cling to it.
So she's right up there, close to the Trinity, as far as I'm concerned.
That's commendable. I'm glad to hear it.
Heretical but commendable?
Well, I don't know. What do y'all think about that? But why does he use the word trust rather than... He doesn't use the word love here.
Or worship.
Well, he doesn't use the word worship here, does he? He doesn't say praise, thank, worship, love. Sometimes I think most Christians would think that it would say love. But worship doesn't say worship. It does say trust.
It doesn't bother me when he talks about his wife being that kind of thing, because I think a marriage is a communion of souls or hearts. Therefore, it's a relationship that would be a communal soul with their God. And I think what he's talking about. Am I interpreting you?
Sounds good. Keep going. Well, I was thinking you shall have no other gods before me, and I would not put her before God, but then I realized to my horror it says you shall have no other gods. So, which is the correct translation?
Actually, I think it's before me. I'm not sure why Luther leaves it out here, the Liar Catechism. There's a lot of controversy in the Hebrew about, my Hebrew is not nearly good enough to ferret out that controversy about what before actually means, if it means kind of in disparagement of take away, detract, priority. I think there's kind of a commonsensical one there. What would happen, Jim, if would anything detrimental happen to you or to your marriage or to her? This fly, I'm going to get this fly. I wonder if thou shalt not kill.
I think you got it.
Did I get it?
It's on your shoulder.
If you did.
If I did what?
Trust her above anything
more
else.
Than God? Well, I don't think I trust her that much.
Really?
I trust her penultimately.
Penultimately.
Yeah, I think ultimately is kind of the word there, too. I think Luther's pushing us to talk about ultimates here. And, you know, that's which we look to above everything else, you know, in which we trust. And to put a human being in that spot is really compared to a human being.
So maybe that's why we put on our dollar bills, in God we trust, just to make sure we let everybody and ourselves know that we trust God above the greenback, right? And then it's okay to do whatever we want, right?
Must be.
I think Augustine said something like that. Love God and do whatever else you want.
Sounds like him.
Of course, I think he had a lot invested with love God, what that meant there, huh? Well, let's think about it. The purpose of this command. Somebody want to take on the next one a little bit? And we'll move along a little faster. The next, let's do four. Somebody do paragraph four.
The purpose of this commandment, therefore, is to require true faith and confidence of the heart, and these fly straight to the one true God and cling to Him alone. The meaning is, see to it that you let me alone be your God and never seek another. In other words, whatever good things you lack, look to me for it and seek it from me. And whenever you suffer misfortune and distress, come and cling to me. I am the one who will satisfy you and help you out of every need. Only let your heart cling to no one else.
Well, so what do you think about that?
A little bit,
that?
A little bit indicted here.
Yeah, what's that?
I feel a little bit indicted.
More indicted. Why is my creed? More indicted. How so?
Well, my heart does cling to someone else.
Whatever good thing you lack, look to me for it and seek it from me.
It gets back to the ultimate and ultimate again.
Yeah.
I don't think we can do this on our own. We can only do it with the help of the Spirit.
Oh.
No. We're too human to do this on our own.
Now, why do you think that's true? Does this just come from your own experience of being
else?
Okay?
We really have to humble ourselves and really confess that He is our own true God and that we can't do this alone. When we come to that point, the Spirit takes over and can help us do.
That sounds like kind of the experience of trust. What is trust always a response to? It was interesting that Jim used, talked about from marriage.
Right? A promise, a covenant?
A vow and a promise. So Luther doesn't yet talk about why trust is so important. He's going to pretty soon talk about what goes together is not only God and faith, but a certain kind of God. That is kind of the coral. It's like a hand in a glove. Now, it's interesting that later on we're going to see that the Bible talks about what the Ten Commandments says. What kind of God? A jealous God. And also Luther is going to talk about a different kind of God, too. Well, let's keep going. It's interesting. What about this? We might think about this ultimate, penultimate kind of question. Are those over against one another, or when might they be over against one another, or when might they actually be, what should we say, more complementary? Or is that a possible? Actually, I think Luther's going to address that a little later before we get that done. So. Well, let's try that. Let's try the next, somebody want to do 5, 6, we'll do that whole paragraph, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, because then I skip to a little bit later.
This I must explain a little more plainly so that it may be understood and remembered by citing some common examples of failure to observe this commandment. Many person thinks he has God and everything he needs when he has money and property.
Gee, it's an old problem, isn't it?
And then he trusts that he holds so stubbornly and securely that he cares for no one. Surely such a man also has a god, mammon, by name, that is money and possessions, which he fixes his whole heart. It's the most common idol on earth. He who has money and property feels secure, happy, fearless, as if he were sitting in the midst of paradise. On the other hand, he who has nothing doubts and despairs as if he never heard of God. Very few there are who are cheerful, do not fret and complain if they do not have mammon.
Well, what do you find there? What's going on in this paragraph? Anything particular?
Don't be too rich and don't be too poor.
Don't be too. So do you fit those qualifications?
Well, it's something that we can say we trust God and still be insurance and all that, so that we're sure that we're taken care of. Mm.
This question about the relationship between ultimate trust and penultimate.
Maybe God uses Lutheran Brotherhood to do divine purposes in our lives. Maybe God uses my wife to bless me.
Did you say Lutheran Brotherhood?
Right. He said Lutheran Brotherhood. Or AAL. You come out of Missouri, so it's AAL, right?
I thought you meant insurance.
Yeah, he did.
This sounds like a simplistic idea, but a number of years ago, the young people of our congregation put on play, and it was in two acts. I mean, the first act, the actors had everything, and they had money, property, and so forth, and they were sinners in small ways that they got across. The second act, the same actors dressed in rags and came out, but they were eternally happy and blessed. And I thought that was the clearest general misperception that we have of wealth and property versus poor and trustworthy and honorable. And I have thought about that a lot of times. Those young people wrote the play. That was their perception. For perhaps they had even studied Luther's catechism.
Or just the Bible, same with Luther.
Or just the Bible. But beyond that, they had no perception of what really what that meant.
But here it says, too, that on the other hand, he who has nothing doubts and discusses that he's never heard of God either. So.
That's right. It's, what's interesting there is Luther covers, he kind of makes conditions irrelevant. One way, I mean, you can sin either way. I find that interesting, particularly in today's world where a lot of times, I think a lot of 20th century theology and maybe before that preaching said, you know, the big sin is pride, and mostly men had it, and women didn't. Luther realizes that despair is also a form of having some other God or no God. I've often found it interesting about Luther, too. I don't know, maybe he's had despair in his own life, or knew people with despair, or just read the Bible and saw despair all over the world, all over the biblical tradition.
I see it.
Probably the latter.
Did his wife tell him that God must be dead because he was so...
Yeah. Is that what Luther's saying? I don't know that.
Well, his wife said to Luther, you know, did God die? You're so dumb.
Oh, yes. That's right.
Yeah, he often went through times of depression.
Melancholy.
What comes after this passage? I mean, how does he get out of this? Because he sort of leaves it open.
He gives some more examples. Basically, he runs some examples here. As I recall, the first commandment kind of lost some of that. Basically, I figured we'd never get very far from this. Right, he basically takes on some examples. St. Lawrence, St. Sebastian, Apollonia, you know, some suggestions out of the saints. Let's see, which one of the curses was flies? Plagues.
Well, I was thinking it's probably Beelzebul.
Right, oh, Beelzebul, right, Lord of the Flies. Well, there, then you
one
have,
of those gods after.
Right, it was. We can look at that one.
This will teach you to talk about this stuff.
All right. Right, talk about the wrong gods. Well, basically, give some examples after that. He moves in now, so I cut out some of those and came up to the beginning of 18. Everyone has set up a god of one's own. There's basically Fred's insight, or kind of what Fred was getting out of that, is that Luther realizes that humans also make gods. It's kind of competitors, huh? To which one looks for blessings, help, and comfort. For example, the heathen put their trust in power and dominion, exalted Jupiter as their supreme god. Others have strove for riches, happiness, pleasure, and the life of ease, venerated Hercules, Mercury, Venus, or others, while pregnant women worship Diana or Lucina, and so forth. Oh, I'm going to count. I'd like to get seven with one below so I can write a book. Everyone, you all know that one. Everyone made it to a god that to which one's heart was inclined. Even in the mind of all the heathen, therefore, to have a god means to trust and believe. The trouble is, now here, of course, comes the crux, is the trouble is that their trust is false and wrong, for it is not founded upon the one God, apart from whom there is truly no God in heaven or on earth. Now that, of course, is the claim that he's not going to redeem, really, in the catechism until a little bit later when he gets into the Apostles' Creed, when he begins now to talk about as Luther arranges the catechism, it's kind of interesting. You remember the parts of the catechism? The first part, the commandments are first, huh? The commandments. The second part, the second chief part, Luther calls it the second chief part of the Christian faith, is he chooses the Apostles' Creed. Not Augsburg Confession. Third part?
Lord's Prayer.
Lord's Prayer. these three things have something in common. Fourth part?
Baptism.
Baptism. And fifth part? Lord's Supper. Lord's Supper. And then sixth part, if you grew up in Missouri Synod like some of us, we learned six parts. If you teach at Luther Seminary, you call them five parts.
Really?
Plus.
Really?
Yeah, most of my colleagues say there's only five parts. So I say it depends on how you count. It's like commandments. What's the second command? What is the second commandment?
Keys and confession.
Office of keys and confession, right? Which Luther sometimes attaches to baptism. Office of the keys. Well, what's kind of interesting about these five or six parts, if you do six, is the first three are what? Are texts. You can read them. They're texts. The last three are more, we might call them actions, events. The first one, obviously, is a text out of the Bible. The third one's a text out of the Bible. Luther says, the commandments tell us what we are to do. The Lord, the Apostles' Creed tells us what God is done, who God is, and what God has done. Luther says the commandments tell us, and I think this gets to one of your comments earlier, the commandments tell us what we are to do, but don't give us the power to do them. And so the commandments kind of leave us hanging, so to speak. They leave us kind of needing to find out who God is.
Would you comment on how some people arrange the catechetical studies they prepare and have baptism first?
Well, I think they might do them. It has to do with how Luther talks about the creed. Luther says, you know, the creed, we say it, Article 1, Article 2, and Article 3. But the creed we really experience, we enter the life of the triune God backwards. In other words, we're brought into the church, we're brought into the life of God through the power of the Holy Spirit, who connects us up to Christ, who brings us into union with God the Father, the Creator. And so baptism, I think, is probably kind of a more experiential way, and our more experiential, although you must admit that the Ten Commandments, think about them, they're rather experiential too. But I think that's why some people start with baptism, and it becomes a way to pick up real quickly on the third article of the Apostles' Creed. That always leaves the question about where do commandments then come in. I think Luther does innovate in the Reformation. When he put together the catechism, there wasn't, you know, I mean, the catechism had never been put together just exactly like this. And it probably reflects his kind of priority of, or his distinction between law and gospel, law and promise. And the Lord's Prayer, nowadays it's if you want to sell a book, you put the word spirituality in the title or the subtitle, preferably the title, you sell a book. Luther's document of spirituality is in the third, and as we'll see tomorrow, is in the second commandment. So already in the second commandment, Luther deals with what today we call spirituality. What's that?
They did some nice stuff with materiality, too, though.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, in fact, that's one of the interesting things about how Luther does
spirituality.
It's not unmaterial.
Yeah.
He does that there. For Luther, this is crying out now. This tells us what we're to do, but doesn't give us the power. This tells us who God is and what God has done for us. This is us crying out for God's story. Kind of connects us and God up. Lord's Prayer. It's also where Luther does what Mike was doing in the Bible study this morning too. Luther builds his theology of the cross into the Lord's Prayer. So the Lord's Prayer is built around theology of the cross. It's a cruciform spirituality, a very kind of materialist cruciform spirituality. And then these are the concrete actions by which the Holy Spirit brings us. There's a doctrine of the Holy Spirit, by the way, in there too. You can spend some time looking. I was thinking about doing the Lord's Prayer. It's kind of fun. Luther does some very interesting things in the Lord's Prayer. Accordingly, the heathen actually fashioned their fancies. Their fancies and dreams about God into an idol and entrust themselves to an empty nothing. So it is with all idolatry. Idolatry does not consist merely of erecting an image and praying to it. It is primarily in the heart. It pursues other things and seeks help and consolation from creatures, saints, or devils. It neither cares for God nor expects good things from God sufficiently to trust that God wants to help, nor does it believe that whatever good it receives comes from God. I must admit, that's probably for me the toughest thing. I think Luther, I've learned from Luther, I think has kind of struck me. Later on, he'll talk about in the article to the Creed, he thinks that the hardest article of the Creed to believe is the first article of the Creed. That is, that God has nothing but good out in mind for us. That is tough to believe. I think it's somewhat easy to believe in Jesus in comparison. There is, moreover, another false worship. You notice Luther, one of the things that, reasons I put this section in there, it's got these marks on it because I forgot to photocopy it before I left the Twin Cities, is Luther's talks about two kinds of idolatry. The first kind of idolatry is this kind of heathen idolatry, so to speak, which Luther talks about. But now he talks about another kind of false worship. This is the greatest idolatry that has been practiced up until now, and it is still prevalent in the world. Upon it, all the religious orders are founded. I think now he's talking about his own religious orders of his day. I think what Luther's practicing here is Jesus' little maxim to look at the log in your own eye before you go trying to get specks out of other people's eyes. Does happen to do with something that you ended up talking about a little bit today too, about interreligious dialogue and fear, what kinds of things you have to fear. I think Luther is saying, hey, when I look at idolatry, just don't look at Jupiter and all the others. The greatest idolatry ever been practiced, still prevalent, is in the religious orders are founded. It concerns only that conscience which seeks help, comfort, and salvation. And now you can see Luther's kind of polemics coming in his own context of his own day. Salvation in its own works and presumes to wrest heaven from God. It keeps account how often it has made endowments, fasted, celebrated mass, etc. On such things it relies and on them it boasts, unwilling to receive anything as a gift from God, but desiring by itself to earn or merit everything by works of supererogation. Superworks, like these fasts and pilgrimages and getting up at all hours of the day and night. Just as if God were in our service or debt, and we were his liege lords. What is this but making God into an idol, indeed an apple god, and setting up ourselves as God? So basically, he's kind of going after the idolatry in his own day. In other words, you think idolatry is just out there with these other folks. It's in the midst of Christianity, at least the Christianity of his day. You might want to talk about how that might show up today. Where might our idolatries surface or stay, remain hidden, you know? What's the log in our own eye?
I was in Italy last summer and I walked into the St. Peter's Basilica and we were there for Sunday service and I found myself thanking God for such a beautiful place, such a grand place from which Christendom is more or less radiates around the world, and the Pope, oh my goodness, and the works of Michelangelo, the whole material thing of church can be very idolatrous.
Seductive, is that what you're saying? Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a little, unless you're Catholic, that sounds a little like them.
I think we can find them.
Church of
Christ. It's hard questions. It's always hard to, it's it's real hard to get a log out of your own eye, I think. In fact, you probably don't even see it. Well, that's interesting. I think that's it. You might ask how that comes about.
I think you're mentioning the growth of churches and how great it is to boast about how our church has grown with all these new dynamic methods that we're learning. Rather than boasting of God, we boast of the wonderful congregation that we're putting together. Since I'm in a sort of a successful mode right now, as opposed to some failure modes I've been in the past, this is very relevant.
I think it's also, right, I mean, a tremendously unnerving thing to think that God does not play by our rules. I know from parish experience in that if you want to convince someone that what you do in your church is the eternal, immutable will of God, do it twice. And we've always done it that way. I mean, it's always hard to do something different the first time. If you do that thing twice, then that must be the way it has been from eternity. And to think that anyone would do it any other way. It's interesting. I'm sure Gary would have this experience too at the seminary. That you get all these students from all over the place, all sorts of different congregations, all sorts of different polities and pieties. They're still basically all Lutheran, but they are just simply shocked and appalled to think that Lutheran worship is not the way they do it in their congregation. I mean, these other Lutherans must just be worshiping other gods, right? It's totally unnerving to some students to think that the world is not their congregation. Totally unnerving.
Well, I have a feeling that we started talking on this one. We could go on this one for a while.
Oh.
Yeah,
just
Fred.
This is a little bit different. I haven't read this for a long, long time.
Glad you're here.
And I am really struck by how often the word heart
yes.
appears in here. And
heart hangers.
Yeah, and I've been, for another reason, teaching students about what our words for faith mean and where they come from. Fact that the word credo, that's Latin for I give my heart, cor and dare,
cor, right?
And our word believe is ultimately back to old German Anglo-Saxon root for the German word belieben.
Was that to remain?
No, the one that means to love.
Believe it, yeah.
Or to fall in love, even. You know, so the whole business of God having his heart given, it's so purely relational.
Yes.
You know, I got to go back and look at this in the Bekenntnisschrift. I don't know if this is in Latin or German, but...
German.
But, you know, obviously Luther's thinking of faith in that way, as opposed to, you know, transactional kinds of thinking, for example, or well, anyway.
Yes, well, actually, the transactional, the more the merit, that's what he goes after here, really heavily hard, is any kind of transaction as far as, you know, we give something to God, God gives something to us. It's kind of this bargaining or meriting. It's in his own time, at least for the dominant mode of theology of his own time. It was quite a different way to think about. If we took a look at Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, we'd see quite a different understanding of the human being. We could do that. It gets a little more of a lecture. I kind of want to move away from that. But it it's a much, the choice of the words are quite different than the tradition, than the middle of the tradition had talked about, which had talked about knowledge, talked about the virtues, for instance. And as you know, Luther says in the beginning of Freedom of the Christian, I've decided to write about faith. Not a few have written about faith, but they've always put it as one of the virtues, and that's only because they haven't experienced the great power of faith. And then he goes to talk about the three powers of faith. Actually, they're the three first commandments, by the way, the three powers of faith and freedom of the Christian, parallel to the first three commandments. Let's do this last bit, well, where time is really up. Let's save this last paragraph for tomorrow, for these last clump of paragraphs, because it comes back to this question about ultimate and penultimate. And Luther was not, he knows what he's getting into in this question. And so you might want to take it home and read it, or leave it here, and I'll pass it out tomorrow. We'll pick up on that, and then we'll do the second and third commandments, which I think Luther, I've been pondering these, meditating on what he's doing in the second and third commandments for a while. And I'd be interested in some of your rest of your thinking and meditation on it. But I think there's some really interesting things going on in the second and third commandment that I basically, in the past, have kind of gone from the first commandment to the fourth, fifth, and sixth. Developing something there that I have been thinking about for a while. Okay, well, see you tomorrow. Thanks for all coming. We're at a different time tomorrow, and I don't remember what time. I'm going to pass those back to you.
Save it from getting markers and buy my fish on this.
Hey, friend, I remember keeping the faith. Talks all about this.
Well,
you just
yeah,
haven't read your book for a while.
Well, I mean, I still remember it.
Of course you do.
It's the whole, I mean, we linked it up with Eric Erickson and Basic Trust, you know, the whole business.
I was going to get into it. There's more. A lot of people are doing basic trust kinds of things, besides Erickson, but we really bought it on, personally.
But the bottom, the last lines on that first page, you know, are sort of where we are. If you make your God your family or your job or your children, you know, and then everything goes to hell in a handcart if you are with no God.
Yeah, plus it puts a burden on them that they can't possibly.
That's
why I wanted to get into the gym a little bit. What would happen if you make your wife into your God?
Yeah.
Oh, what a terrible burden. We do that with our children all the time. A lot of us do anyway.
Make her bear the meaning of your existence.
Yeah. Well, that'll kill anybody. That's enough to kill anybody.
Probably more dead marriages from that than.
Right? You have so much invested in them at the beginning. Yeah. And you have so far to fall then.
But I really was struck how often the word heart is in there.
Yes.
Because it really makes me aware of how he thought. And so it's purely relational term.
Yeah, a different kind of relationality. The rest of the tradition is gonna talk about entirely different. You know, the Thomistic tradition and both the Via Moderna and the Via Antiqua are gonna talk in an entirely different way. And it's all intrapsychic. It all has to do with the virtues, self-development, teleological, character, ethics. It becomes, yeah. And for Luther, it depends on.